I'm Amy.
I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast.
I do want to tell a story at some point, something that happened to me like 2 days ago. I've been telling everyone about it because it's so insane that it happened.
Well, you can open with it if you'd like.
Yeah, I got a I got my first scam call.
Oh.
Yeah. Someone said, called me telling me that they were the IRS and that I owed them $7,000. And I talked to them for 40 minutes and had no idea for 40 minutes.
Oh,
that,
no.
Yeah.
Did you give them personal information?
No, I like to think I'm smart enough to know there. They're like, so they had all these like tactics that I've been thinking about ever since it happened that got me. Like they kept telling me like if they, like there was a consequence if I hung up. Like if you hang up, there's an arrest warrant that'll be issued to you immediately and they'll come to your door in 40 minutes. And like they talked very fast and they kept moving me around to different people. But anytime I had like sort of like a red flag moment, they just moved on to something else and there wasn't like any time for me to really like understand it.
Sounds like they're good at their job.
Yeah, they were very good. It was very impressive.
But what was like, their end game, do you think? I'm always wondering this. Like, just personal information?
No, so this is, yeah, like, if they asked me for my social security number or something, I wouldn't have told. Like, I would have known, I know that much, at least. But for this one in particular, they wanted me, so they said that I owed them back taxes from 2012 to 2016.
Sure.
And I had to pay them now. There was an arrest warrant out for me, and it was coming to me immediately, within 45 minutes to an hour, and I could either stop it, or they'll take me to jail. And they kept asking me that. They're like, do you want to like have the cops show up at your door right now and be arrested, or would you like to pay the $7,000? And I was like, well, I don't want to do either. And they're like, no, you can't, you have to choose one. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't yell.
You're fine.
Okay. It's like, do you want the arrest warrant or do you want to pay the $7,000? Like, well, it's like, well, I guess I don't want to be arrested. It's like, okay, well, which one is it? It's like, I guess I'll pay the money. I don't really want to pay the money either. It's like, okay, so what you can do is you can drive to Washington D.C. and defend yourself in court. Would you rather drive to Washington D.C. or pay the $7,000? I guess if those are my, yeah, I'll pay the money, you know. And so that was their plan, was that they wanted me to drive to like to get a Western Union like government check.
Whoa.
And then send it to them immediately.
Made out to cash.
Yeah, yeah. Made out to cash? What?
Yeah. He used to... Oh, maybe that's an old reference. When you wrote a check, like a personal check, you could write it out to cash. And then whomever has the check can go to a bank and get it for cash. So, like, there's no... So, years ago fraud, there would not be a paper trail with this person's name on it.
Mm.
Person would receive... It wouldn't be like, what are you, Joe Smith? Because you'd have to show an ID at the bank, because even though it was years ago, you still had to show an ID at the bank. But it was like, especially if they didn't know you. But it's like, if you wrote cash, any Joe Blow, you could drop that check on the ground, somebody could pick it up, it's their check.
I see. See, I never use checks. I very rarely use checks nowadays.
I don't think they make checks anymore, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
but,
it's all done now.
But yeah, that's why I didn't realize how like dated it had become. Like, yeah, write it up to cash. Oh.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's not you.
But yeah.
That's hilarious.
With this, the whole thing, there are all these like... like things that happen that is like, oh, I'm such an idiot, of course, but I didn't understand. So like immediately they asked me for my information. I'm just like, what's your name? And I was like, Mohit Jaswal, MohitJaswal. And it's like, what's your address? And I was like,
oh my god,
my address. And then 15-20 minutes later, she sent me to another officer, and then he explained to me that they sent me two letters in the past that I did not respond to, and that's why the warrant's happening now. And I had just moved within the last year, and I have four roommates currently, so in my mind, I was like, well, maybe that makes sense. But then I was just like, wait, what's your address did you send it to? And I just heard like this like pause, and it was like, 2A, blah, 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 this street. And I was like, man, that is my address. Yeah, I guess I just missed the letters. I can't believe it. And then it was only afterwards, like, you idiot, you gave them the address. Like, he was probably just reading the piece of paper that the
watch
first
out for
sent
your you didn't give him anything other than your name and address, did you?
That was it, as far as I can remember.
Watch out for other, like, mail fraud.
Oh no!
Save your name and address now.
See, I've been wondering what else they could do with just that little bit of info.
Yeah, they could probably do a lot of things, but don't worry about it because they're not great. Mm. like I've had my I try to be easygoing about it because I had my social security number stolen like 4 or 5 times. It really hasn't affected my life that deeply. They really sell you a hill of beans about how, like, if somebody takes it, you're up Schitt's Creek, and you're not.
Yeah, I wonder about that. Like,
nothing happens to you.
I wouldn't know what to do with someone's social security number.
If you say it happens to you, you know what you do? You call a hotline, and you leave a message. And nothing happens after that. At all.
Really?
Nothing at all.
You don't get a new one, or I don't know.
No, that's it forever. I mean, your social security number is your social security number. You're not going to get a new one. But, I mean, they can put it on high alert, and mine's on, like, constant high alert. They're always asking me weird questions. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, right. I'm me. but no, this was when I was in, right after college, I moved to New York City, and I got a bank account at HSBC, which I found out later watching a documentary, was one of those ones that was stealing a bunch of money from everybody, so whatever. But hey, they were nice to me in this moment, because when I went to apply for a new account, the woman was like, your social security number shows associated with a different person. And I was like, oh yeah? And I had the card with me, so I was like, see, it's me though. And she's like, yeah, I do, I see. And she's the one who helped me get the information. She's like, well, hey, if this happens, you know, you need to call. I had to call some, like, verification company, like an official bank thing, where, like, I checked in with them and they said I was cool and they gave me, like, an okay code, and then I gave it to the bank. Mm-hmm. The bank gave it to me, so I figured it was legit. I wasn't like, okay. But then she gave me this number and was like, this is for people whose social security numbers are stolen, so you should contact it. And it's just a government, like, voicemail. Where it was all like, hello, thank you, I'm terribly sorry you're having trouble with your social security number. Please leave us a message about what's happening to you, and we'll get back to you if we need further information. I mean, whatever.
So did they call you back?
No, never. Never, ever.
Oh, okay.
Never heard about it. Also happened when I was a child. What? My social security number was stolen. And I was a child, and records showed I was a child. So they were like, excuse me, sir, you're trying to buy a house with a child's social security number attached to your application. And then he skedaddled, but I got, and then we got a letter, because, you know, letters, to my parents that said, so-and-so is using your daughter's social security number. Can you send us a copy of her social security number, like a copy of the card to, like, this federal agency to confirm? I was like, sure. The funniest thing about federal agencies is they don't talk to each other. The other thing that's funny about federal agencies is the IRS is not going to arrest you.
Yes, and well, yeah, everyone explained that to me.
It's okay.
After 40 minutes, like, of being on the... Eventually, they hung up on me. The guy was just so fed up with me.
Not giving the information to him?
I wasn't doing it on purpose, either. I was just, like, just sincerely wondering what was happening.
Yeah.
And, like, eventually, that's yeah, so he was funny. Just like, you gotta go to... you got to drive out. You have to get this, you know, bond right now. It's like, well, I can't. I'm at work. He's like, Mr. Jaswal, some things are more important than work. And you can, and this is way more important. You have to go. And I was like, well, I don't think I should. I'm the only one up here. I'm a projectionist at the Alamo Draft House. So
sure.
I was like, I'm the only one up here. It's like, you have to take this more seriously. And it went back and forth for this whole, eventually I just heard him go like, ugh, and then hang up. And then I immediately called my dad. Because anything serious happens, I gotta call my dad. And I was like, this is what happened. I think the IRS is on me. Has this ever happened to you? I think I owe them $7,000 and the whole thing. And then he was just like, well, sounds like you're going to jail for a very long time and we're not gonna see you. You're joking. He's like, of course I'm joking. Google IRS scam. It happens all the time. Like, they never call you.
Like, they don't call you.
Such a dad joke to give to me.
It was like, the idea too, where he's like, "Well, I guess she'll be in jail then." Like as if in reality that would be his reaction. No, that seems like a logical place for my son to go.
Yeah.
Jail. Like what?
Like he messed up. That's it. The end of that.
You can't mess with the IRS. So why didn't you pay him originally? He's well, like, Dad, I did.
It's like, I've done some dumb things that maybe I did another dumb thing. I don't know.
Yeah. It's all right. You can be real dumb and people aren't really going to... It doesn't really hit you that much. All sorts of things. Like I know that, you know, you went to college and stuff, but lots of people that don't, I'm always like, it's not a big deal. It doesn't matter at all. Like, in my friends... One of my friends has a 16-year-old son. We were just chatting about school or whatever, because he babysits the baby sometimes. And I was like, he's telling me about some grade he was worried about. And I was like, hey, man, worry about anything. In the end, no one will ever ask you about your high school grades. Never, ever.
Mm-hmm.
I go, once you get to a certain point in your adulthood, which is usually 21, no one cares what happened before that. No one will ask you questions.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to look at your transcripts. There's no permanent record of any kind. Just be a nice dude. Literally all you gotta do. Whole life. And he's like, okay. And I was like, so study for that test, sure. But don't really deeply worry about it.
Well, yeah. But like, during that time, especially high school, like, your bubble is so small. Like, everyone around you is just worrying about the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
You don't really have to worry about any, you know, major, like, most people, like... don't have, like, all they do is just work, so, like, it's easy.
The beauty of being a student, for sure.
Yeah, so it's easy to get caught up and think every test is, like, life or death, and so I got caught up in that.
I mean, when you get to the higher levels, when you get to, like, college and stuff, and that feels really serious.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when your whole life is this, like, one show or this one film, this one project, it's like, oh my God, if we don't do it, and then it's like, it's fine. Like, you're gonna be all
right. Right.
No matter what happens, it's going to be okay.
Yeah, I remember, I went to a film school, North Carolina School of the Arts, and they tried to make it like a mini Hollywood system, essentially. And so that meant, like, a lot of competition, and you had to present your, like, pitches to, like, the teachers in a way that, like, as if you were presenting it to an executive board of directors that were, like, going to give you money and all that.
Oh, so they, like, taught you how to do a real pitch?
Yeah, and...
That's helpful.
Well, because actually School of the Arts is, like, pretty, like, special as far as, like, film schools go, in that they actually paid for your films.
What does that mean? What do you mean they paid for?
So, first year films are free, but second year films, I believe, were... anyone that was allowed to make a movie got $500 budget to make the film. And then third year films were something like $1,000 or $1,500 or something, and then fourth years were like $5,000
or something. Oh, great.
Yeah, but what that meant was they only had enough money for 10 directors, 10 cinematographers, 10 producers, etc. So your first year you do everything, and then your second year you go into two disciplines that, like, you declare what you want to do. So I did directing and producing, and then by the end of the year the faculty chooses for you which one you can be in, and then those... Yeah, so, and then if you're not good enough, they just cut you from the program.
Like, you can be like, thanks, you're not in college anymore?
Yeah.
Like, that's a thing that can happen?
Yeah, there's, like, a big deal that happened the year above me, where, like, they cut, like, 20 kids from second to third year, and there's nothing wrong with them as far as, like, GPA standards or anything, and,
The School of the Arts program.
Yeah, and so then there's a broad rumor that someone sued the school because of that. Someone's parents did. And then, so they entered, like, an interdisciplinary program. So now, if you don't get into either, they just put you in there, which means you're just kind of, like, doing anything you want. But you don't get to make a movie through the school. You don't get that funding and go through that whole process.
Or get the degree at the end that says you had the School of the Arts degree.
No, you get that.
Oh, so if you're the interdisciplinary peeps who are kind of in the low totem pole, you still get the...
Yeah, you can still... It's essentially, you still attend classes and do everything, but you don't get that, you know, that free money and the, like, you know, that little, like, p- pitching system that everyone else went through, essentially.
Sounds like it's not exactly free money so much as earned based on the pitches.
Yeah, free money wasn't right. It was extremely stressful to get that.
Yeah. But that's really how interesting that they taught you how to do the pitches. Like, in what manner? Like, the only time I ever hear people talking about pitches, because I'm very comedy-centric right now in my life, are, like, television shows and stuff like that. But did they teach you how to pitch, like, a movie to a studio? Like, was that the style of pitching? Or was it as if you were pitching to, like, an arts organization trying to get funding, like, grants?
Kind of like that, which it wasn't, like, it was mostly just, like, getting to the point of your film, like, understanding the theme of the film, and just, like, explaining why this movie is important, what's your connection to it, and just kind of, like, guiding people to do that, instead of, like, what's the movie about, not explaining the plot, because most of the time people don't care about that when there's money at stake. It's,
yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know,
that part can even change, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, what do you feel?
Right, yeah, and then it got deeper, like having like a budget already made, or like having the crew already assembled, and lookbooks, just explaining like the look of the film, things like that, and then it would just depend on the faculty, like how deep they wanted to go with it. If it was just like this, like 1 to 3 minute sort of elevator style pitch, or if it was this really broad, like, process involving everything I just said.
Yeah
that
sounds awesome, though, that you have the experience of doing that, if mm-hmm. only just because you probably will be expected to have that kind of information when you're making movies with studios. So now that you know what to do, because I was thinking, like, there's a lot of different things that I want to take a few little classes, not because I really like intend to move to Los Angeles at any point in the near future,
mm-hmm.
but because I think it's my duty to teach people how to move to LA. Like,
right.
Like, in my opinion, I'm going to keep teaching, so I want to go and find out how you do things in the real world, so that then I can go, okay, if you'd like to really do this, take this workshop with me, and then I will teach you what I've learned, because you are going to go to there and need to do this, and, you know, I want to help you. Because in my mind, I just want to help people get the work done. So
right.
I love this. Tell me more about the school, because, like, when I was growing up, I heard about the school, and then when I went to college, you know, you'd hear about other theater schools.
You'd heard about School of the Arts?
Yeah.
Oh, neat. Okay.
So when I knew you guys had gone there, but I was always impressed by that. But tell me more about it, because I don't really know that much about it. What's the school like? What's the vibe like? What was your like directing and producing stuff like?
So, first of all, it's a fairly intense process to get into the school. I went 2 years at UNC Greensboro because I didn't, like, I was scared at the time to like dive right into like a film career. Like, I've known I wanted to be a filmmaker since I was like 12 or 13, but when it got to that point, I thought maybe I'd major in English or philosophy or something.
I was a bio major, I understand.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, then, but then
for like, about 10 minutes.
Yeah, then 2 years go by, and I'm just like, I was still like undecided. I'm like, what am I doing here? So then I transferred over to School of the Arts, but it's a conservatory, so I had to start as a freshman.
Sure.
And I went through the application process, and it's like, it felt like I was applying for like a grad school. Like multiple like essays, I had to show like a reel of my work, and like other like full examples of my work as well. And then like I had to go over to do an interview process with them, and like a lot of things that I was just thinking, like, if I was like 17, 18 years old and just getting out of high school, like, that would be so overwhelming.
Oh, so I guess it was a good thing you had a couple of years to kind of chill out and figure out you as an adult person before you had to do all that work.
Yeah, but so it, like, it made me take it super seriously, because then they
like you already have to make a film before you go to film school? That seems crazy.
Basically, yeah.
But I guess you know, you said you wanted to do it since you were 12, so I'm sure plenty of other people are just like you.
Yeah, so essentially what that does is, like, people, like, me or just people that just like know this is what they have to do, that's the people that get into the school. So everyone's just super like into it, serious about it.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to go through this absurd application process if you're not.
Totally.
Yeah.
So tell me about your directing and producing track. Like when you first, I know that you said that they chose and hold the what they chose, but tell us what happened during that time when you studied those both, and then tell us what
gotcha.
They chose.
Oh, gotcha. My second year? Okay,
yeah. That sounds fascinating. Two cool things to choose, and then knowing you now also like, oh, cool.
Oh.
That's how you learned all that stuff. It's
yeah,
okay.
Basically.
But yeah, tell me what it was like.
Yeah, okay. So
it sounds fascinating. It sounds like such a good program.
Well, I've always wanted to be a director, but everybody says that. Anyone that's in film school, like, you know, there's a film school teacher, producer, Stephen Jones, who I think used to be a Marine or something, but his role first year, like, he was just to make us all feel bad and make sure that we really wanted to be there. And, like, on the first day, it was, every class was about 80 kids each. So the whole school had about 500 kids or something like that. So first year we had a bunch of like all school classes and with all the first year and Stephen Jones, he's like, now how many of you want to be a director? And I'm like, friggin' 60 out of 80 of us raised our hands. He's like, you know, out 4 years there's going to be 15 of you that actually become directors, you know, and it's like, this is not going to happen. Like, just change it at now, figure out if you actually want this, you know.
I feel like that's
like really hard.
That's some high hopes for 15.
Yeah, I made
like
that 15 number up, but it was a very
80.
Low. Yeah,
but yeah, because like, shit, that's a lot,
right? But he was like, change it now, figure out what you want to do, you know. And
yeah,
I owe him a lot to like, for us to take it seriously that year.
Well, it sounds like they do a lot of things to cut the wheat from the chaff. They have, every year there's a new, like, chance you're not part of it. So if you continue to make it through, you're, like, the level of not only you but your peers is higher now because they've let go some of the people that weren't working up, you know, didn't do as much as they needed to. And now, like, so by the end of your first year, are they cutting people as well?
No, first year...
Or is it just they let it happen?
First year, you could be cut, but nobody really does first year. Really, that's just the year to explore and figure out what you want to do. So what's different about Schoolyards is they really pushed filmmaking.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, most film schools, you don't get to even touch a camera until your third year in the school. This place, you can be on a film set your second weekend in school.
Hmm.
And everybody makes a movie their first year, you know. So... the first year, the big project is everybody makes, everyone has to be a key position. So everyone has to produce someone else's film. Everyone has to direct their own movie. And then that gives you the knowledge to know like what you actually enjoy for the second year.
So then you did the directing and producing track together.
Yeah, I did not enjoy producing, but I knew that's what I needed to do. Like I knew I wanted to make my own films without anyone's help, as minimal help as possible, like, because I, you know, what got me into making movies was seeing Reservoir Dogs, El Mariachi, and Clerks especially. And just seeing how they all basically just did it themselves and with very little money. So I always just kind of assume whenever I got to that point, that's how I would do it. So my second year, I figured I would need to learn how to produce my own stuff, even though it's like super boring to me, but it's just necessary, you know.
Did they teach you all the different kinds of producers, like in a big film set, or was it just sort of like this group is, you're the producer on this film, and then you just sort of handled everything?
What do you mean by that? Like,
well, like in my mind, and when they're making movies, and you know, because you legitimately have a degree in it, I am just gleaning from what I listen to on from my people that I know, and then podcasts and whatnot, so believe me, correct me if I'm wrong. But from what I understand, there's various different producers that work different jobs. So, like, there'd be one producer who's in charge of, like, making sure there's money. And then there's one producer who's in charge of making sure everybody's getting along. And then there's another producer who's in charge of making sure the actors say the actual words from the script.
Mm-hmm.
And or writing down what they do say. And then there's producers. So there's people that are, like, producer. The word producer can mean any number of things in the real world of, like, multi-million dollar, because mm-hmm. I feel like executive producer is just a title for friends and family, from what I understand. And then
money.
And then various other producers along the way have different, like, consulting producer, line producer, this kind of producer, and it's like it just sort of gives an inkling of, like, what they're in charge of. Mm-hmm. I've always thought, and I don't know anything about it truly, but I've always thought I would, if I were to be a producer, I would want to be the person who makes sure everybody is okay and doing all right. Like, I'd be happy to walk around a film set and just make sure everybody's having a nice time and, like, they're doing their stuff. And can I get you? How can I help you with this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, just to make sure everything's flowing and moving forward and getting that kind of stuff. I'd love to be that kind of person. I don't know if that's a job, but...
Well, kind of. That's kind of... So, one of my teachers, who I forget... who, but they said this and it kind of just stuck with me, of, like, the difference between, there's the first assistant director and there's the producer, and they both kind of work together as far as running the set. The first assistant director basically is in charge of the day. They're the schedule, shot by shot, and they, like, make sure that they end the day 12 hours a day and make sure everyone's just, like, where they need to be when they need to be there, you know? And then the producer is kind of there for the whole day. The whole, like, the whole arc of the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
They're making sure the whole thing is working.
Like, big picture.
Exactly. First assistant director, day by day. And he was like, the producer, if their job is good, then they don't have to even be on set. They don't even have to worry about the day. They can just worry about the next day and keep going. So, those producers that do show up, they're like, yeah, they're the ones that get to be very kind and open and just happy to be around because they know their job is done. If they did it correctly, all their job happened before the shoot even started.
Right on.
Like, they're in charge of, like, yeah, hiring everybody and getting locations and all that.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, that's okay. How that ends up happening. The super all right, nice
so they trip. Handle the, like, setup of the whole thing, making sure they've got the permits and the locations and mm-hmm. the people to do all the work, and then... the action happens,
mm-hmm.
and they just facilitated the whole thing.
Yeah, so that's kind of how we did it in school. And then, like, you can break that down and, like...
So the director's just another creative part. Like there's a costume designer, and there's a director, and there's an actor, and they're all sort of different creative parts of that part.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, you know, assistant director seems like in live theater would be sort of stage manager.
Yes, exactly. Stage managers, yep.
But the producer is a... more of an overarching role.
Yeah, and they really stress, like, the role of a creative producer. Mm-hmm. So, I guess in their ideal world, the producer would find a script, like, find a screenwriter that has a script and, like, get that script from them and then figure out the best talent involved to work on that script. They would, like, this director, I know his work, I've seen their reel, they would be best for this. And this cinematographer, the way they light would be great for this. And then they bring in.
Oh.
And so it is, in a way, it is the producer's vision just as much as everyone else's.
Well, yeah. They're putting all the paint together before the painting gets put together. That's fabulous. That's interesting to think about. Yeah. I wonder, too, because I'm coming at it from a writer's point of view. So I'm like, right now I'm on a lot of, like, screenwriters Facebook groups and, like, a couple screenwriting, like, other like Twitter crowd people things, and the one thing that they're always talking about is the idea of, it's like, in order to get your stuff made, if you're not making it yourself, is you have to get, like, a famous person attached to it.
Yeah,
and I always thought, how do you get a famous person attached? Like, how do I find... Number one, how do I find a famous person? Number two, how do I convince them to do it? But I realize now after this discussion, it's not my job to do that.
No, it's not.
It's yeah. a producer receives my script, says, I'll work with this,
mm-hmm.
and then tries to find the famous person to do it, and it works or it doesn't. Fascinating.
Yeah, you're basically doing the role of a producer if you are looking for actors and things. Huh. You're kind of, yeah. Which is also helpful in itself, but that's essentially their job, is to figure out, like, how to get funding for this, and one of the ways is to get a major actor involved.
Yeah, because that person is usually like, yeah, I have deep pockets.
Yeah, so those kind of, well, no, I mean, like, if...
Sometimes.
Well, yeah, for sure, but also, like, investors will be more excited if they know there's, like, an actor they recognize, right?
So. But there's people like Brad Pitt, for instance. I feel like the last four movies he did, he was a major producer on it, because he's, at this point, he's done enough movies that he's like, yeah, I don't need to do every movie. I'll just do the, like, five cool ones that I find and think I would love to work on this. And then if he loves to work on it, why not throw some cash in?
Yeah, that. So. And I also think that means that they also get, like, final say. I'm not sure on that. I think that, like, when you see Brad, executive produced by Brad Pitt, I think that also means they get to control the narrative. Like,
well, I'm sure every arrangement is different. But yeah, I mean... If I were to get to that point, I would, and had the quote final say, I'd still be like, well, let's just make sure we get a director that we trust, or like an editor that we trust, so I don't have to look at every possible thing.
Yeah,
like it's like, no, thank you. But you know, who knows? For those people that have been in Hollywood for a long time, I'm sure they get bored with, you know, just acting or just doing one thing, especially if they start getting to know people and then they're like, okay, I could really do this. So yeah,
you see that a lot in like TV shows. I know, I'm thinking about Breaking Bad now, of how Bryan Cranston ended up directing a couple episodes towards the like the later seasons, and that seems to be like a reoccurring thing, like an actor just being around set enough and like being best friends with the crew that they give it a shot, and then making their own features afterwards, maybe.
Yeah, trying to try their hand at it. Yeah, if you get to know a group of people and they trust you, why not be like, hey, you know, I'd love to try this. Yeah, let's do it. I mean, there are some, like, what was it, I can't remember what show it was, but it was like I was watching some really deep intense movie, whatever it was, and at the end I looked at the like list of a director and actor and all the things, and the director's list of movies he had worked on had a few really whimsical, funny, and like, and I was like, what? This is so different, you know? And I just thought how fun it is to, like, have that, have the ability to try on different hats and to put your, infuse your style into that. Tell me about the directing. So, spoiler alert, you decided directing was your thing.
Yes.
You took the directing and producing tracks, and at the end of the year you were like, no, thank you, I'll be a director. Did the
actually
agree?
No.
Oh, no.
It gets even more, like, there's some drama involved with that.
Oh.
Yeah.
You can share or not share. No pressure.
Yeah, it's essentially, I made a film, and it got a pretty great reaction at the time. No one, to my face, criticized me, so I assumed it was good enough to get in to the directing program, and then they chose producing instead. And I was just so fed up, because I really, like, it's like a real, like, just bust your ego, you know? It's like, this is a thing I've been working towards my whole life, and these, like, five teachers decide that, like, my dream is not happening anymore, and I just got really, like, you know, fed up about that. So, Interdisciplinary came out, so I was one of, like, the rebels that was like, I'm not choosing producing, I'm choosing the interdisciplinary.
Oh!
No one knew what that... They thought I was making, like, a really bad decision at the time, and they were just like, no, you want to do producing, and like, no! And it was just, like, really angry, like, I'll do my own stuff, I'll make my own movies, and, it turned out to be a great decision, because they had no idea what interdisciplinary was as a school, and so I was the first class of it to have it, so it just felt like the Wild West. Like, they had a structure, but I would go talk to my advisors and be like, I don't really want to take this directing class. Can I take something else? And they'd be like, yeah, I don't see why not. And then just kind of scribble it out. So I just got to pick and choose, like, based off of, like,
Yeah,
the material or the teacher or something. If I didn't like something, I was like, I don't want to do that. I'll just take this. And I hear nowadays it's way more, like, structured. Like,
oh,
you have to take two directing, three producing, or whatever. But So I just did anything, and then I like found the classes that if I took them, the electives, if I took these electives, then they would let me rent out the school's equipment for free. And so I would take those classes specifically, so on weekends I would just rent out like thousands of dollars worth of equipment at a real rental store for free, and then just make movies, make my own music videos on the side. And I was like, getting back at the school at the time, that's how I felt. I was like, you told me I can't direct, I'll show you, I'll use your equipment. Yeah.
So does that mean then that you ended up making movies on your own dime? You didn't get the funding?
So I didn't get the funding, but
But you learned how to do it without.
I basically learned how to, through loopholes, essentially. Very open loopholes. Like, I mean, they knew what I was doing. They could have stopped me anytime, but like, they were fine with it. Yeah. I basically just took the classes that taught me how to produce, and then I produced my own stuff, like finding cinematographers that were into what I was doing, and it was just a lot of hustling, which is what I do now, the same, it's just a great practice ground for it.
Yeah. So. I was like, I feel like that's kind of the gig.
Yeah.
Hustling.
Just constant, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how it ended up happening, and it was great.
So then your degree is in the interdisciplinary studies, or is it still show, a degree like a bachelor's in directing, or...
I think officially it just says filmmaking or something like that.
Oh, okay, because it was the overarching department and then the smaller things underneath it.
Yeah, I don't think it says it on any of them. No. I don't think. I haven't looked at my diploma in, ever.
I'm pretty sure mine is just in Latin, so I don't look at it too often. I'm like, whatever this means.
Yeah, any time anyone asks, I say directing and producing just to make it, just so I don't have to go through that whole story every time, Actually, there was a crazy thing that happened,
Yeah, well, it's all right. It's a podcast. The crazy thing that happened is exactly what we're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what happened after college? What was your first adventure? How did you dip your toe into the filmmaking world outside of college?
Well, I knew I wanted to do comedy in some form, but I didn't know what that meant exactly. Like, how to get to where I wanted to be. I didn't know what those first steps were. So I talked to one of my producing mentors, Bob Goss, and he was a producer director that lived in New York City for most of his life. And so I knew I wanted to do comedy and I wanted to move to New York. I don't know why. It just felt like the right thing.
It feels like that's where comedy lives, believe me. I understand. Mm-hmm. I moved there too.
Yeah.
So tell me what it was like for you.
What year was it
when you moved to New York? Or wait, am I jumping too far?
So I basically asked his advice a little bit, but skip to the end. So I asked for his advice, and he was like, well, I know a couple students that work for College Humor now, if you want that. And I was like, yeah. And so I had an interview, and I got this like production assistant job with College Humor. I moved up there, and I took two jobs. I worked on like two or three Jake and Amir episodes or something, and then the week I moved there, they announced that they're moving all of their production offices to LA, and I'm stuck here, first time out of North Carolina, 2 month sublet in Brooklyn, and I'm just like without a job
all of a sudden.
Yeah, and so I just kind of, that was a big shocker, like, welcome to the real world, this is how it goes.
Yeah.
I
did New York three different times.
Yeah, I keep thinking about going.
I failed and then went back and then failed and went back.
It's alluring. I keep thinking about going back. And I'm not going to, but
I mean, if what you are looking to do is there, why not? You know what I mean? I say be wherever the vibe that you want your life to be is. Do you want it to be New York or LA? Do you want it to be Canada? Do you want it to be Rome? Who knows? Like, you could be like, I really want to make these specific kind of films. Well, it turns out they make them in Sweden. You want to live in Sweden? I'll do it. So if the things you want to do are in New York, even though it's hard, it's going to be hard everywhere. You move to Omaha, it'll still be hard.
It's true, yeah. I've been thinking about that a lot lately, of like what the city can do for me. The energy of New York City is so like aggressive.
It is.
And I think that like really sharpened me up pretty quickly. In ways that like Austin just does not do. I mean, Austin's great for like different reasons.
Yeah.
Free love kind of bullshit. which I love, but it's completely different, you know.
That's the new phrase. It's not Keep Austin Weird anymore. It's just free love bullshit. It's perfect.
I got so tired of the amount of times I read love on, like, I love you so much, just on graffiti and everything.
Yeah.
Get out of here with that.
No, I mean, Austin definitely has its eye roll moments for sure.
But
I mean, you know, if you like the push of New York City, it's very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I worked, I just tried to work on, like, as a production assistant, just did that gig for, like, 3 months. Worked on, like, a low-budget feature film, and I worked, the best one was a failing game show for NBC.
Ooh, fun.
A Million Second Quiz. It was very, very great. I feel so lucky to have been part of a failing game show as it's happening. I feel like I could talk about that for like an hour, but basically the whole thing was like, it was a 2-week long process, and they tried to make it the biggest game show in history, so they got all these major like Ken Jennings and all these past like game show winners and celebrities to be in it, and the first night tanked. Just very low, awful ratings for a number of reasons. But we were stuck to 2 weeks, and so we all had to deal with just, like, the whole company's like, well, this is not working, but I'm still clocking into work for, you know, 13 more days, and, yeah.
Wow. So, like, from the very beginning, so, like, they made you do all 2 weeks of the event, even though, was it, like, live broadcast?
Yeah, so it was a the reason why I failed basically is that there's too many gimmicks. Like, I think modern, like, audiences trying to watch it at like 9 p.m. were just overwhelmed and didn't want to commit to it.
Yeah.
But it was like a 24-hour game show. It was like part reality TV show, part game show. So like contestants could, like the top something like 8 contestants on the ranking board would have to live on site, and we were only live, and you could watch them on the NBC website.
So it's kind of like a Big Brotherish thing, sort of.
Yeah, exactly, partially, and then we were only live
once a night.
Yeah, every night at like from like 8 to 9 or something like that. But then you could continue watching online or something.
What a crazy thing!
Yeah.
What year was this?
2014-ish, I think.
2014. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like crazy to see people. Like 24 hours a day.
Yeah, it was around the time where it was still like, I think that's died down a bit since, but
you know, they don't do it as much anymore, but yeah. I wondered if it was like, this was the first time they tried it, this was earlier, and so people were like, what? I'm not interested in that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So I wondered where it was in the timeline of people being interested in watching a 24-hour situation.
Right.
I mean, people have watched, you know, panda bears for 24 hours, so it's hard to tell what people really want to look at, but
mm-hmm. Yeah, so man. I was in charge of my station was like holding the contestants until they, like, you know, and like I remember it most in like American Idol, like usually the first episode of just like Ryan Seacrest is like, let's take a look at all the applicants or whatever, and just like a montage of like the same shot of like, you know, my name's Cindy and I love gymnastics or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I brought people into the room where they got to film those things, and like they like filled out a form explaining like what what 3 interesting facts about you, or like why are you here, just like something for the director to work with.
Yeah,
the guy was super great at his job, and it was so fascinating to watch these people like turn on these personalities, you know.
The contestants,
yeah like they go into the room and it's just like, you know, all right, when I say action, you've got to say, my name is, you know, he like looks at the sheet Gregory and like, you're into math. Yeah. Say you love math so much. He's like, I love math. I get it. Okay. You know, and some guy from Nebraska, like this is his biggest dream is to be at New York City on this game show.
Yeah.
You know? And it was just like heartwarming and sad and really endearing, the whole process.
So did the whole process still continue? There was a winner and that winner won something? Despite the fact that there was no audience excitement?
Well, yeah, so they had to give a winner, and it was like a million seconds. So the way it worked, it was like also like a Who Wants to Be a Millionaire style game show with like multiple choice, and you're battling someone else for like a minute at a time or something, and whoever got the most questions right would get on the money chair. And if every second you were on the money chair, you won like $1,000 or $100 or something. And a million, there's always like a million seconds is roughly like 2 weeks or something. So
sure.
That's why it was called Million Second Quiz. And yeah. You possibly won $1 million. There might have been more to it. But the top four people would get into the finals. And then those four people could battle it out to see who actually won. But those four people rigged the system immediately. They all found out that they were the top, and so like basically they like helped each other out to make sure that they were going to stay the top. They did, like, the idea was like it's a battle, like who could be first, who could be, you know, like who's gonna get it. But like once these four people got in the top, they just like talked to each other like, yeah, let's just help, like let's make sure that no one gets us out. And so they yeah, and so they made sure, like, they like, yeah, I don't remember what exactly, but like they helped
each
other.
Did they make this decision once the show was kind of tanking heavily, or
no?
This was early on
the contestants.
Four, yeah.
No, they just. I mean, I don't think they knew that it was.
Oh, they didn't know
because they were living on set at the time.
Oh, right. Probably best.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that's fascinating.
And apparently they were all like game, like they all took game shows as their full-time jobs. Like they all just like, they just traveled around Jeopardy and like Wheel of Fortune and stuff.
Wow.
And they all knew each other beforehand.
Can you imagine?
Which, like,
what a weird little group.
Right?
That exists. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, the whole experience. Yeah, like I had no idea until
that there,
like,
are people. Oh my god.
What?
Every time I find out about a wildly specific thing like that, it's like, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I was like, these guys are so smart.
That is so wild,
making
yeah.
Making great choices in life.
Makes me think of Magnolia.
And, yeah, right, yeah, because I thought about that too, and I didn't realize it was real. Like, like to that extent, like seeing it firsthand, you know.
They're like talking to each other like, hey, great job on Jeopardy last week.
Yeah, and basically, yeah, they're like, this guy, he was on Jeopardy 2 weeks ago, and this guy, you know.
I only know a very little bit about game shows because I was a little obsessed with Press Your Luck, and it very recently came back. Like, it's not current, meaning like nobody is new is doing the show, but the episodes from the 1980s were put on to this channel called Buzzer, which is an antenna channel that you can get, and then Amazon picked up Buzzer, so now I can watch every episode of Press Your Luck.
Oh no.
And I have multiple times,
I'm sure. Yeah.
But because there's only like 3 or 4 years in it, and I've like become obsessed with it. Like, I've read as much as I can on the host. I know all about him, his life and his death. Like, the guy that, like, figured out the system. Because, like, I don't know if you know Press Your Luck, but it's multiple screens. Like, a little box moves around and you get whatever dollar amount is underneath the box. But the screen changes between, like, five different screens as it's moving. So it could be on $1,000 and then switch the other screen and you get like loser or whatever.
Oh, gotcha.
So this guy figured out the rhythm of the switches and won so much money to the point where they had to establish a rule that people couldn't win more than a certain amount. Like, once you won a certain amount, you got retired. Like, once you won X amount, they'd go, thank you so much for being on the show. You've reached our limit, so we're going to have a new person with us. You have a great time with your winnings. Because this guy had, like, figured it all out so much, and he was just winning so much that they were like, this guy's taking all of our money. and then somebody realized that he was rigging it. Like, and it's almost like he was counting cards. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't like there wasn't any mechanical way that he was changing anything, but he just was watching the flips from screen to screen so he would know when to call it. And because it's a computer, and it was a 1980s computer, so it was very probably easy to follow.
Right.
I mean, I've watched it every episode, and I'm always watching it to try to see if I can't figure it out, and I cannot figure it out. But this guy, I mean, who knows?
Is that show still on?
No.
Oh.
No. This was like, I want to say it was like 84, 85.
Oh, gotcha.
Years and years ago. This was like my early childhood. I remember the sound, and then when I was watching a commercial for the game show channel, all of a sudden I heard it, and I was like, what's this show? And then I was like, oh, I remember this one. And then I just got obsessed and watched every single one of them. And it's fun with the baby, too, just because there's a lot of lights blinking, and it makes a lot of noises, and it's very exciting. Like, ooh. Everything that happens, they'll be like, oh, my God! Oh, no. So they ask a bunch of questions, then they get a number of spins, then they get to spin the wheel and get money or whatever.
I never thought of it that way. That's probably why people like it so much. Just like a lot of spinning objects and like light up lights and wacky sounds.
Yeah. Plus, if your brain works like that guy's brain and you want to figure out patterns, because like a lot of people just play puzzles or do like logic games or like figure out that kind of stuff, and that's the stuff they dig. So when a show involves like a visual puzzle that they can also be working on while they're doing these other things, it's a win-win.
Yeah.
Plus, wow. This is a ridiculous piece of detail that I know, and I'm going to tell you because no one will ever care about this, but right now we're in this discussion, so I'm sharing it. The host of the show, Peter Tamarkin, was such a nice guy that he died in his own private plane with his wife delivering cancer meds to a cancer patient.
Wow.
After he made money being a game show host, he and his wife put all this effort into personally delivering meds to people who couldn't go to hospitals or pharmacies. So they would get meds from wherever and bring it to them because they couldn't. And they did it for years. And then, you know, poor guy, just small plane, one time. And that was it.
What
was
did he like, do? What did he died on the plane?
Yeah, they crashed the plane.
Oh, he was flying the plane.
He was flying. It was his personal plane. Yeah.
Oh.
It's his personal plane. And he and his wife were just doing what they do, delivering meds, and they just crashed.
Oh, gotcha.
You know,
okay.
Like any plane crash, it happens. You know.
I thought you meant he had like a heart attack on a plane. That was like the weirdest detail to me.
No, he didn't die on a plane that way. He crashed the plane.
That's tragic.
He was flying. Yeah. Yeah, super tragic. But I was just like, huh. I was like, what? Bless his heart. He was saving people. He was trying his best. And he did it. And I was like, wow. That was such a wild thing. Like, what a crazy game show host, like, life.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's very.
Who was the host of the Million Second Quiz?
Ryan Seacrest.
Really?
Million Second Quiz, yeah.
Ryan Seacrest. Can I write that down?
You can. Yeah, you should check it out on YouTube. It's really interesting to watch.
Ryan Seacrest, so you got to meet Ryan Seacrest.
I peed next to him once, and that felt like a really big deal to me at 22 years old, 3 months into New York City. I was like texting all my friends.
You're peeing next to Ryan. Like, oh, that's a pretty big deal.
I thought about, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, I thought about like, well, what if I knee him in the balls right now? I would get on TMZ. I'd be on the news. I'd be famous. And I was also drunk when I said that. I was at like an after party. My friends were like, don't do it. No.
So
okay. I'm 22.
The worst part is it's like, no, you'd have to do it directly in front of the paparazzi. If you did it at a party, you'd just get taken away.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. I would get that precious news story I was looking for.
If you're looking to get in front of the paparazzi, you got to get there first and then do your thing.
Mm.
If we've learned anything.
That's what this is all about, finally. Yeah. I'm glad I stopped by.
So what's the stuff you're working on now? What's your dreams? What are your efforts for being a film director? What are you doing at the moment?
Right. Well, so I guess I'll take just a few steps back. When I moved to Austin, mm-hmm. I was in this mode of just making movies and just like just learning as much as possible. Essentially, what happened in New York was I learned I didn't want to be a production assistant.
Sure.
Not that I'm like above it, like I'm totally fine with that, but the system at School of the Arts, where I was a PA my set like second, third week of school as a freshman, so I felt like I was already a PA for 4 years, essentially, and then like starting over, just like I wasn't learning anything anymore. Like, I felt like I had already learned what I could from being a production assistant, and it just seemed like, I don't know. I just felt like there were better ways to do it. Coming to Austin, I just started making a movie a week. I did that in film school, and so I picked it back up with Nathaniel Hendricks. The whole point of it was just do not care about quality, do not care about lighting, anything, just work on movies and learn something from it. Like, I think I lost most of them, honestly. I didn't put them online or anything. They were just meant for me and him. Like,
what do you mean lost them? Like,
like
erased off a thumb drive or something?
Yeah, I just don't know where I put them. Like, they're on my, I may have just, like, deleted them on accident at some point off of my computer, so. I don't remember. But, yeah, like, it was just getting together and just, like, figuring out different aspects to work on, like, long take shots, like, how do we do that? How do we keep people's interest doing that? Or just a movie with fast editing. How do we, a gross out movie, just doing things constantly. And I kind of kept that phase for like the last, I want to say like year and a half or so of just trying to learn. Eventually it became a movie a month.
Okay, I was going to say,
yeah.
Did you make, like, have you made like 60, 70 movies?
Yeah, no, it didn't go that far.
Okay.
we had like a good phase of, I think we made like 12 to 15 or something before we just got exhausted with it.
Yeah.
So we learned enough, you know, and then it turned into one every month.
And these are short films, right? They're not a 2-hour movie.
Oh, no, so
a week.
At that point, yeah, the movie a week was just like, could be anywhere from like 30 seconds to like 2 minutes. Never anything longer than that. Just like practicing.
Yeah.
And then all the sketches were like all like 3 minutes long or something. I was like, I'm pretty like strict about keeping sketches like short, like getting the joke and then getting out.
Yeah, that's smart.
Thank you. yeah, I don't know. I just get so bored. I get bored so easily that like,
yeah,
of my own stuff too, that I just have to cut.
But, 100%. Yeah. It's really funny to me. I feel the same way as far as like, I will, my first draft will be extra long and then I just rip it to shreds. You know what I mean? And I work with people who do writing all the time, and sometimes they just can't let go anything. And you're like, you don't need this whole page. Get rid of it. Just skip it.
Right.
Or like, I've gone in like with the neighborhood when we have really new writers. If I feel like I need to, I'll say to them, can I do a pass on it? And they'll go, sure. And then I just go in and try to make everything consistent.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like, this guy's angry the whole time. Great. Everything he says is angry. He's never going to be, like, making a joke. Nope. Like, that kind of stuff. But some people get so precious with little things. And they're like, well, you took out this joke. And I was like, that joke actually contradicted this, this, then this for the plot. So I had to take it out. If you want to put it back in, we just need to find a new spot for it. Because right in that area where it was didn't work. So,
mm-hmm.
And I'm just very into structure. So I appreciate the idea of cutting things down to 3 minutes. Because I think that you don't need anything longer than that.
I think that's so essential of cutting, killing your darlings. Like that, like not being too precious with the material. I think that's one of the major things I learned from that like movie a week process of like just... Yeah, I love this, but it just doesn't work with what I'm doing. So I'll just have to cut it and just show it to my friends on my own time.
Yeah. And
that's where it's going to live from now on. It's sad, but this is the better movie or better script or whatever. And
so you guys
difficult.
Were essentially workshopping just different things you wanted to learn, figuring out different styles and seeing what felt good to you, or just trying everything so that you could check it off a list of like, I know how to do this.
A little bit of that, yeah. A little bit of, like, just, like, how do you do this? And then also just... It eventually evolved into... When I was a movie a month... What, like, those movies I was able to show at Fallout Theater. Just various sketch shows at the neighborhood a couple times and
mm-hmm.
everything. And those kind of turn into... You know, just, like, what can I do with the audience? Like, will they laugh at this dumb joke that I... thought of at 2 a.m. and like, oh, they laughed there but they didn't hear. And then it, like, those videos I made with the Texas Dog Show, the video sketch group I was in or still am in, were like, they they were created out of, like, aggression, of, like, me being really frustrated with my life, and, like, you know, like, New York didn't work out, and all this other stuff wasn't working out, so I just, like, just tried to make really angry, gross comedy as, like, a catharsis, and when people started to like it at the shows, it became this, like, thing, this, like, contest with myself of, like, oh, you laughed at this? What if I do this now? You know, like, how are you still gonna laugh at this? And, like, just, like, how far can I push it? And that was, like, just such an invaluable lesson for me of, like,
now you're a real comedian.
Really? I guess it was a similar process, like, I mean, stand up or something.
Yeah,
like,
that's what we're all trying to do.
I mean, definitely went too far in a couple of those shorts, but, you know.
Why not?
Yeah, like, oh,
I mean,
it's
you have
very,
to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you have to try. I was listening to an interview with Howie Mandel talking about how he, when he first started, he didn't know what he was doing, so he would just do one thing and just keep doing it and see how the audience reacted, and that there is an arc of, like, they like it, they like it, they like it, they don't like it, they're very upset that I'm doing it, they're yelling at me now, they find it humorous again, they're endeared to me, they're laughing again.
Oh.
Like, the up and down of, like, they like it, they hate it, they like it, they hate it, and, like, pushing past through that part where they're like, stop! Don't do that again. Why are you doing this? And then till the point where it finally gets funny again. It can be so hard for everyone involved, especially in his case, doing it live performance-wise.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you can, you know, use the audience as a sounding board that way, did you learn a lot from the one-upmanship you were doing with your videos and the audience?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I felt a little bad sometimes, like, making people, like, have to sit through some of this, like, pretentious
crap. All I
do
is mess with the audience.
Yeah,
oh, man.
It's the best. It's horrible to do sometimes, but, yeah, no, it was just so great to have that, because with movies, you don't really get that opportunity. Like, you spend, you know, if it's, like, even a short film, like, the films that we made at film school would take all year.
Yeah.
From, like, development through shooting to editing, and there's very little time to, like, know what you were doing was even good, if it even worked, other than just what other people told you, you know? But
yeah.
This was very, like, in my face immediately. And it was nice that it was comedy, because, like, it's very obvious if people get the joke and they're laughing or not. So it was just immediate feedback with what I was doing, then, like, okay, great. Next movie is, you know, is due in a month. Let's just see what I can do now, you know?
Yeah.
So.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I can't say, I don't really know. I just know it, like, I absorbed it. I can't say exactly what, like, I can't give, like, advice, but I just know doing that process, I absorbed what I know, what my limits are, what I'm, like, actually capable of.
Yeah.
A little bit better than before, at least.
Well, I feel like as creative people, you know, like you just said, I don't know that I'd be able to give advice on it. So it depends on what part of the journey we're at, whether or not we're even truly able to give advice. Like, I bet you early on gave some, you know, good thoughts about college and like, even your college and the way to handle going through it. So it's like, a person listening to this who might be interested in going to your college is now like, oh, okay, now I know, and they've learned. But you're right in the thick of your current,
mm-hmm.
like, figuring out what you're doing, so don't try to analyze it yet.
Sure, yeah, definitely.
Whenever I feel like I'm in the middle of a creative problem, I try not to get too swept up in knowing what the end is,
mm-hmm.
because I don't know. Like, I don't know what I'm going to learn, I don't know what I want to focus on, I don't know what it is that, you know, I want out of the process. So, yeah, doing some comedy videos and, like, dealing with the audience and having them react and being able to change it. What would have been interesting, too, would be to, like, adjust, like, reshoot stuff to, like, see if they laugh in a different way.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just to do the same video multiple times but change it based on the audience reaction and see if they can help you to improve it. I am often a proponent of, you know, you really can't tell because I mean, it's almost like your class. You're talking about how your class had 80 people in it. Well, that's how many people are in the audience of the Fallout, right?
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
That's your handful of people who are going to give you their opinion in the moment. Now, I truly think that to get, like, big audience reaction, you need a much bigger sampling of people to show to see how they react. If only just because people are across the board different. And the people that go into comedy theaters, ours in particular, are very specific.
Right.
Like, even when I get new people to the neighborhood, I explain to them that satire is okay, but it is very specifically, has to very specifically be written in a way that, like, the audience is going to react to. Mm-hmm. And the number one thing you need to remember is our audience are liberals. Mm-hmm. Don't write a pro-conservative sketch. It's just not going to work here. Mm-hmm. We've tried them. Like, we've had sketches where, like, the idea of it comes out, and then we're like, oh, no, they're not going to... They're going to hate us because we're telling them they're dumb. It's like, yeah, no. How about we save this for the people who already think this crowd is dumb,
yeah,
and then we'll play it for them? You know, it's like comedy has an audience. And I'm not, I have no specific example of that. But it's like, in my mind, it was like, this is who's coming. And it's like, even like, don't write sketches for people in their 50s not coming to the theater. It's not working out. We did the neighborhood at the Hideout, the audience was older, and they had a very different sensibility. We, 1 month, during all the madness, I wasn't sure it was happening, so I called the Hideout and asked if I could do the neighborhood there for a couple months, because I just didn't know.
I remember,
And so they said yes, because they're lovely. And the second month, Fallout was back. It was, like, happening. So they were like, hey, you can do a show here, too. So I did one at the Hideout and one at Fallout. And it was very interesting to see how the exact same sketches got such different reactions. Like, totally different. The parts that they loved, absolutely the opposite parts. And I just, at the end, we had this discussion, like, we sat, me and the writers and the actors sat together. We were like, that was fascinating. Why did this crowd laugh hysterically at this thing? We can get a peep from this crowd. So interesting. Like, and we tried to figure out what it was that they thought, because I was like, this is where we have to figure them out. But, you know.
Did you ever get any...
I mean, we had a little bit of insight, you know what I mean? Like, the joke that got the biggest laugh at that Hideout was a dick joke. It was a long scene, but the joke was just a dick joke.
Old people like dick jokes?
Loved it.
Wow.
Loved it, loved it, loved it. They laughed themselves sick to that one. It got maybe a, huh,
at the,
in the 20-something crowd in the basement. Like, they were like, oh, I get it. And you're like... Dick jokes don't work with 20-year-olds, I guess.
Yeah, that's weird. So, I love dick jokes. I'm glad to know that's going to, like, stay with me for the rest of my life.
Yeah, people love it.
I'll never get tired of them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's great that you had that. Also interesting that the audiences would be so different. The two theaters are only, like, a block away,
yeah,
2 blocks away or something.
So close.
Yeah.
We thought the same thing. But, like, the whole vibe of the space was different and the whole setup was different. I mean, not, like, you know... Not, like, from our standpoint, but, like, the way they enter into the space, the way that it feels.
Yeah.
And then they had given us a Saturday night slot, so it was packed. And they have a theater downstairs and upstairs.
Oh,
so the downstairs theater had a show, and we had a show. There were two huge lines to both.
Wow.
I was like, what? This is crazy.
Which theater did you... I've only been to the upstairs one, by the
way. The upstairs, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and how many people... It feels big. Is it...
The upstairs one?
Yeah, how many people can...
Oh, I don't think it's that big, actually. I mean, I think it's probably, I don't know, it might be 50 or 60.
Hmm. Maybe it's because it rises up. I feel like that maybe adds to it in my
Are
head.
Are you thinking of the down one? Because the down one's big. The one downstairs is a big theater. It's a big old stage, and then it has a very intense... riser situation, like the audience goes up pretty high, and there's a lot of room in there.
I might be thinking of that.
I've never seen a show in there, but I've done workshops and auditions in there.
I've only been to Hideout like once or twice, and that was during South By just a couple months ago. So,
yeah, right on.
So my memory's a little bit hazy about it.
Yeah, I mean, but it's
just
wild. The like that there was there's so much stuff going on in there. Yeah. And I was glad that we were able to, because they were even, when they gave us the show slot, I was like, it's okay if you need to put us on a different date. Saturday? Saturday? You have Saturday? And they're like, yeah, yeah, it's fine. We can have you on Saturday night. And I was like, you don't have another show? And they're like, oh, no, we just don't put shows up in that top one when we have the other one. And I was just like, okay. I don't understand why you wouldn't, but
yeah,
hey, whatever. But maybe it's the noise or something. I mean, we're loud enough that we don't care if there's somebody else being loud in another area, because most of the neighborhood stuff is yelling.
Right, yeah. Most of the comedy, good comedy is yelling.
There's a lot of yelling. So now we're here in Austin, and despite the fact that it doesn't have the intense, you know, push of the energy of New York City, does it still creatively fulfill you in its way?
It does, yeah. I've learned so many other lessons I would have never had the ability to have, like, in New York or anywhere else. A lot of, like, personal care, self-improvement things that I've tapped into communities here that have helped me, like, understand myself and helped me grow into, like, a deeper sense of empathy through the people here, the culture here, and, like, everyone just is laid back and just more, like, welcoming in a way that, I guess, yeah, I mean, I'm sure New York has that, too. It's just such a big, I don't mean that in a condescending way. It definitely sounded that, but, like, it's so big that it would have taken me a long time to find those communities and, like, and get there.
It's sort of a harder place.
Yeah.
It's like people have a thicker skin on them. When I moved there, it was right after 9/11, so it was very snuggly. It was surprisingly snuggly.
Yeah.
The view was militaristic. In every subway station, there were guys with AKs guarding all over. But the people, the humans, not that these men with guns aren't humans, they were, but their job was to be automaton, you know, like, don't mess with anyone, I'm watching you. Okay.
Yeah.
But everybody else was, like, loving each other, hugs, everyone was very soft, because there was a lot that had gone on, and everyone was sort of emotionally worn, and I moved there after. It was about a year after, and I moved to New York City, and so everyone was just, it was a lot quieter, it was a lot slower, and it built to it. I mean, I was there for 5-6 years. By the time I left, it was back up to its swing, and everyone's skins came right back on, nice and thick. Don't mess with me. But when I first got there, it felt very warm. So I think that's how I immediately got involved in, you know, like, comedy scenes and stuff like that. Though, to be honest, long story short, when I got into comedy, it was because I had a unrequited crush on a comedian.
I've heard.
I mean, it was just. Yeah. Yeah.
I think you told the story somewhere. I heard you tell a story on stage or something. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like, you never know what's going to lead you there. And I was like, man, if I didn't like this dumb dude, I never would have done this. Like, I was doing Shakespeare for years before I got into comedy.
Was it worth it being in New York? Like after all that, like, overall?
Oh, yeah. I mean, both sides. Okay. When I first worked in New York, I was working on, instead of, in your experience, you're working on film, so you're a PA.
Yeah.
I was working on live theater, so I was a stage manager.
Oh.
And so I did stage managing for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, I don't want to be, kind of like your PA thing, I was like, I don't want to be a stage manager. I'm good. Like, yeah. I want to be part of the creative part. I don't just want to be the organizer. It's great. I'm glad it's a skill I have. I will note that. But no, thank you. And so after that, I kind of lost all the jobs. Like, I went to New York for a stage management job. So when I decided not to do it, you know, I had no money coming in. And that's when I had to go around and figure it out and see what's going on. And then, you know, you bump into a cute boy and follow him somewhere. And then all of a sudden you're doing comedy.
Yeah, what can you do? There you go. But talking about aggression or bringing it back to New York reminds me of this story of, like, when I first moved to New York, I was just so innocent. I was so innocent being from North Carolina. And I would see, like, people, like, just talking to themselves. like homeless people, like just yelling.
You were gonna say just regular people.
I mean, like, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I don't like assuming, but like, yeah, they just just kind of yelling to themselves, talking, walking in circles, and like, what happened to them? And you know, like day 5 or 6 of that Million Second Quiz show, I'm walking home after like a 15-hour day, like just dealing with the craziness of New York. And to get to my apartment, I was in Bushwick, so like in that particular area, the subway went right above on the street. I had to walk for like 3 blocks, so like the subway would walk, and then like the subway would come by as I was walking, and just the loudest noise that would be sustained for like a minute. And I would just be like, that one day I was just walking and I was like talking out loud, like, I can't even hear myself talk right now. No. And then like I noticed nobody was looking at me, because that's just the culture of New York, is to ignore anything weird.
Yeah.
I was like, no, they're even looking at me, this is insane, I hate this place. And then I realized I became a New Yorker in that
yeah.
moment.
Yeah. You got it.
I was like, damn it. It already happened. It's only been 3 weeks.
I actually, my theory of New York is that it's mob mentality, like, every minute. Like, when when people get into crowds, they can be easily swayed. Because, like I said, we're animals. So, doesn't matter. If we're in a big crowd and something happens and people get scared, people get trampled all the time with something like mm-hmm. an enclosed space, and there's a fire alarm, people get trampled. No one's trying to murder people. No one was like, I'm gonna go to this event and stamp on a person's head, but they're scared, and in that fear they go do that. And same with New York, there's so much happening, the loud noises, the craziness, the inconvenience of literally having to walk so far to get to the entrance.
Oh,
you're like,
God.
Why can't I enter there or there or there? Nope, the entrance is way down here on that far end corner, and by the time you get there, 3 trains will have passed that you will have missed all of them. And you're like, ah! So there's a lot of frustrating shit that happens there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like because it's so packed in, the energy of our frustrations rub off on each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can't get away from each other. You know what I mean? Like, crying on the train, or having a really deeply emotional moment on a train. It is packed with people. And whatever you're reacting to, a breakup, or like a weird date, or like a job interview that didn't go well, you could bawl straight out, full on, in the middle of that subway station. No one's going to look at you.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to judge you. And no one's going to, hand you a tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all of those things. But they'll feel it. And they'll, even if they don't, they, like, get that little tinge of that emotion comes with them when they get off the train. And then they bring it to the next. And it's like all the energy just built up together. Because you can feel it, like, physically feel it. When you...
Yeah.
Because I'm from Boston. And so I didn't fly to New York City. I took a bus in the first time I ever went. And the energy, like as soon as you cross the border into the city, you feel the nervous energy. It's like, you know, like you get it. And you're like, okay.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it's weird.
It's wild getting into like Penn Station. I don't know if you ever had to take
yeah,
a train
yeah.
in. But like, yeah, just
mm-hmm.
like being in this very nice, gentle, quiet train and opening the doors and just being blasted with the worst of New York City, the worst of Manhattan.
Yeah.
Right in your face. It was always, yeah.
The hot, the smells, the noise.
Just nobody's happy at Penn Station.
No one.
Yeah.
Never.
It's rough.
Yeah, it's not a good time at Penn Station. It's almost like Grand Central is the sort of artistic version.
It's beautiful. That place is beautiful.
And somehow
never.
The flow of people works better. I don't know
yeah.
why.
Well, there's like, it's just so like romantic. Like people have taken
yeah.
these beautiful photos and just like, you know, paintings of the area. So you like, oh, like it's like being in Paris. Like, oh, I'm in Grand Central Station.
It
oh
is like
God,
being in
know?
Paris. You're right.
Yeah.
yeah.
There's like, yeah. And Penn Station is just grimy and awful and nobody's happy.
It's terrible. Yeah.
yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible. Everyone's always sad and nothing works. There's kiosks everywhere that tell you you should be able to buy your ticket using this kiosk. Doesn't work.
Those, yeah, the people that work there, they have to you know, they have to deal with so many dummies just asking them the same question over and over again. I can't.
So much stuff.
I just, yeah, I have. It makes sense to me why they're just like, get over there, row 3H, just move now, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have to answer that same question 50 times.
Yeah. I would never want to. I've thought about living there again, and my husband is not well suited for New York City. He could never handle that energy. Mm. It would decimate him in the long term. And so I imagine now I'm in my 80s and I come into money somehow, and then I just go live in New York City.
Yeah.
It seems like I know that seems like the silliest place for a person to grow old there. You wouldn't think. You're like, you know how many stairs you have to climb in New York City? Why would you want to go there? But, you know, you can figure stuff around. And also, like, if you get yourself in a certain spot where you can walk to your grocery store or to the place, like the bowling alley or the movie theater, like whatever it is that you're going to do, like, that seems sweet.
Yeah.
A tiny little corner of the world. Yeah, you're in this big city with bustling, but if you just stay within your 4-block radius, like, eh.
It's funny because I've had the same fantasies of, like, growing old and, like, living in New York again.
Yeah.
It's not fun to be struggling there. It's one of my favorite cities to visit.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm not strong enough for it. I don't know. But I love visiting. There's so many great things about New York. Places to see. And the people, even, like, that are, like, living through it, you know?
Yeah, making it through.
Yeah, they're all. It's just all so fun and fascinating. But to go through those trains, going through above your head, and just the noise. And
it's so intense.
The energy. Yeah, too much.
Yeah. Plus, Penn Station's got... Sorry, it made me think of too much. It's got not only, like, the bus station, it's got also the trains. Like, so there's so many levels of underground being used all at once. Like, just the energy moving all around you. It's like,
Yeah.
So much. Wild. Yeah, Austin is definitely different from New York. It has a cooler vibe to it, a smoother situation. I'm glad. I like to hear that since you've been here, the people have shown you compassion. That's nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. I wonder if that's an Austin thing or if it's an adulthood thing. You know, it's hard. Because when you get older, you start sort of realizing there's people that aren't just you. Like, when I was a kid, I didn't know. It was just my journey, and the world was the backdrop of it. You know, I was Felicity, and the world was my whatever.
There's part of that, like, you know, like, definitely just growing up, I had this vision of being this, like, giant major director. Like, I'd make my first movie. You know, I had, like, the ages set. You know, I'd go to college of this, and then, like, 27, I'd make a feature film. Because Orson Welles made a movie at 27, and, you know, then I look at, like, my favorite directors, like, he was 25 when he made his first film, and so I just always had it set in my head in this, like, really manic, like, way that this is my life, and then when things didn't work out the way I thought they would, it was really, like, yeah, like, crushing for me, and it was very, like, self-centered of, like, the world is ruined, you know, is crumbling all around me, and that just happened to be around the time I was in Austin, living in Austin. And so that definitely takes into it of, like, being like, just, okay, it's not about me. Hi, Ellie, how are you doing? What's your life like? You know, and
I'm glad,
like,
you had your friends around you during that time. That's good that you had, like, a good support system. Because it can be hard during all the... I mean, we all go through ups and downs, but when you're having a particular down, it's nice to have your people with you.
Mm-hmm.
People that have gone through your experiences. And because Nathaniel went to college with you, too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like you'd met. It's like you have a history, as opposed to, like, just being like, help me, stranger.
Yeah.
I've asked strangers
Nathaniel,
for help. But,
you know. I didn't know Nathaniel that well in film school, actually. Mm-hmm. He was a year below me at the time. So, like, we had been around at parties and stuff, but we didn't know each other that well. But, yeah, he's really helped me out. He saved me from a lot of, like, troubling situations in Austin. And he's really been there to, like, pick me back up. Like, I was, like, homeless for, like, a couple weeks, I believe, when I first moved. And he was just like, I've got a couch, you can stay here for as long as you need. And, like, he was, you know, just always there for me, so.
That's good.
Yeah, he's been a very good friend.
Yeah. Yeah, that's nice. That's good that you guys have each other. Are you, so what are you working on right now? What's your, what's the thing that, like, you know, when you leave, you're going to be thinking about? What's the project gnawing on your creative bone?
So we just finished a short film called Butt Fantasia that we've been working on for a year and a half.
I think I've seen you talking about that.
Yeah, that, so the culmination of, like, the Texas Dog Show, in my mind, at least, like, all these movies, like, sketches that we made each month, like, ended up with this film, basically. I think it's the culmination of my stupid period. I'm hoping to do something more serious afterwards. I'm very happy with it, but it's, yeah, it's, yeah. And so that's happening, and I'm working on a feature script with Nathaniel and Red Jefferson.
Good. And,
yeah. So we Skype once a week, and we're just like, been doing that for about a year as well.
Are you writing it?
Yeah.
Oh, so you're in on the writing part as well?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not, I've had to learn how to write through this. Like, again, going back to just, like, shooting it myself and purposely not being a PA, like, I have to do it all, so... Yeah. That script probably, I think, has taken a lot longer just because I'm like teaching myself how to do it.
Sure.
But that's almost done, and so we're gonna be looking for funding soon, and hopefully shooting it next year.
Right on. Yeah. How are you? Well, you said you're working on teaching yourself to write. Have you like read books, or are there websites that you go to, or is there like a podcast that you listen to that helps you with your writing techniques?
Script Notes is great. Mm-hmm. That's just about screenwriing. And in film school, I've just read every film, filmmaking book I could find. And a couple of them, which I can't say off the top of my head right now, but I was like really into the hero's journey. So just like learning as much as I could about the hero's journey. Oh, actually, on my phone, I have... as my wallpaper, Dan Harmon's Story Circle, which you can kind of see.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I found that.
Are you familiar with it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I personally have been looking up story structure when it comes to screenplays, because I wrote my first draft of one, and then I edited it 6 or 7 times, and then I put it down for a while to let it sit. And then I went back to it, and I was like, no. So now I'm trying to rewrite it, but I feel like I wasn't sure exactly if I was telling the story properly, because I was feeling like, oh, man, I've lost these threads. So I started doing all this research on storytelling, and I found that. But I found a couple other things, too, but I just wondered, you know, so whenever I talk to somebody about it, and it's like, that's what I'm working on, so I try to pick people's brains to be like, what do you look at? What things are you into?
Well, the story circle really opened me up. That's what where I finally understood the hero's journey. Because I was, like, really hesitant about that whole thing of how, like, every story is the exact same. Like, you know, you don't want to, like, it feels like, you want to be your own person, your own creative stories, and have that. But no, Dan Harmon just like explains it really perfectly. Of like, yeah, we've been telling stories for like how many like you know decades now, like how many hundreds of years. Like it, they're all the same. They all hit the same whatever, like 6, 8. They're all the same 8 spaces. But it's how you get to those spaces. That's where the creativity comes in.
Yeah.
And, so,
plus we've all watched a movie that didn't hit one of those 8, and you were like, wait, what?
Because, stories are in all of us, so, like, you know, when that doesn't work, you know, you just know it intuitively, like, something's wrong, and usually what's wrong is they didn't explain one of the beats properly.
Yeah.
It's wild whenever that happens, so, yeah.
It's tough when it's like a Hollywood movie, too, because, like... My husband will pick movies back and forth. Like, he'll pick one, then I'll pick one. And I like to pick real randos. I like trying to... Either I go with an actor, and I'll just find something random that they did. Like, I made us watch all of Nicolas Cage one time.
Ooh.
I was all like, no, let's do it all.
Oh, he's great. I love him.
But there's about six or so that are the exact same movie that he made. Bless his heart for doing all six of them. But they're just like him playing the same character with the same situation in a different city written by somebody else, right? Mm-hmm. But when you watch these movies, sometimes you'll, especially when you watch one where you notice the same thing, you're like, oh, did he? It's funny because there's actually two that he's in that are essentially exactly like Taken. And he just has different reasons for why he's seeking out the people that have kidnapped his whoever, mm-hmm. his wife or his child, whatever it is. And when you watch it, you know, it's funny, you get used to the beats of it, and then you watch it and you're like, wait a minute, wait, we've lost this. Where are we?
Right.
I don't know why he's mad now. What's going on? He's running. Who are you running from? You know, the different things where you're like, did that get lost in the cutting room floor?
Right, yeah.
But I don't know. It's fascinating to me. I am, like I said, I'm part of a few screenwriting Facebook groups, but that can get a little yucky. I try not to pay too much attention to it, but I also try to be supportive to fellow artists, and that's not really what it's about.
Yeah. Dan Harmon and then the South Park guys have very good advice that they
oh, yeah.
The way they write scenes specifically is fantastic. Of always making sure you have like forward momentum with your stories, with each scene. What is the phrase? Each scene should always start or should always end with a therefore or but and never an and, I think is how it goes.
I had somebody on, there's five or six helpful people on the Facebook group, and this one guy wrote this long story structure thing that helped where it was like, at the end of every part, you should have a new question. Like, but wait, what if she does this? Or why isn't she getting the thing she thought she was going to get? Or what happened to the dog? Like, whatever, you know, so it sets something up so that you then have a question to explore with the next part. It's like, he's like, don't think of storytelling as facts. Think of it as setting up questions. And I was like, ooh, that helps me. But yeah. I think there's just so many ways to say it because we're all creative in our own different ways.
Right.
So our brains all work differently. So then seven people have to describe it seven different ways, the exact same thing,
yeah.
for my brain to get it and your brain to get it because they're different. So
yeah, really, yeah. And that, what I've gotten to the point at with the script, it's taken me so long, is just realizing I need to just write it knowing I already have this in me, this structure already in me, and I just have to write it in a way that I find entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever like my like internal compass starts saying to myself that it's bad, then I can like rework it.
Mm-hmm.
And fix it. And just like, it's just a bad idea for me to be worrying about the hero's journey while writing it and worrying about hitting these specific beats or anything like that. Like,
yeah.
Then it just becomes like a formula, and that's where it's bad. But it's
yeah.
great as like as a guide, as like a like light posts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you're lost, you have that above to get you to the next step.
Yeah. So you're like, wait, what do I need to do next? Yeah, right on. That's
yeah.
interesting. I find most of this stuff, though, is in the editing. The first draft mm-hmm. is just word vomit.
Yeah.
Like, it's just get it out as much, as quickly as you can.
That took a while for me. I've gotten a lot better with doing that. Of just knowing the first draft will be terrible.
Yeah.
But I, you know, it took a long time just like, no, this line is bad, or this dialogue doesn't make sense, and just rewriting the same scenes. And you can't do that when you're doing long form stuff. You can, it just eats up time. You've got to get those pages down.
Yeah.
Get them to other people and to figure out where you're at.
Yeah, totally. Fascinating. Well, good. I'm excited that you're working on fun stuff and that you get, you know, new things in there. I'm excited to see Butt Fantasia. That'll be fun.
Yeah, I could show it to you soon.
Yeah,
yeah, it's finished. We're taking it way more seriously than usual. We're sending it to festivals and
good.
Keeping it offline until like we know where it goes.
Yeah, exciting. Festivals are where it's at.
Yeah, so we're really like trying to push for like, yeah, we've practiced as much as we can in the last couple of years, and now it's about getting ourselves out there and figuring it out. So it's, I'm pretty excited about it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me and spending the time and sharing your experiences with the audience. So you know, future filmmakers can hear it and go, oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
I can do that. That seems fine.
Oh, this is so great. Yeah, no, I'm so, like, happy that you asked me. This has been so fun.
Good, good. All right. Good night.
That was great.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast.